It's Friday on Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So yes, it is time for the week in review, beginning with the Trump administration's decision to rescind the DACA program. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
The executive branch, through DACA, deliberately sought to achieve what the legislative branch specifically refused to authorize on multiple occasions. Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch.
The Congress now has 6 months to act. If it doesn't, President Trump says he may step in.
Congress, I really believe, wants to take care of the situation. I really believe it. Even very conservative members of Congress, I've seen it firsthand. If they don't, we're going to see what we're going to do.
The move drew sharp condemnation from many Massachusetts lawmakers. Here's Senator Ed Markey.
This is heartbreaking. It is unjust, and it is just plain evil.
And Congresswoman Catherine Clark.
What the president has done here is really unspeakable cruelty. He has put 800,000 people into terror.
Well, joining me now to talk about the Trump administration and DACA, plus the rest of the week's news, is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Richard Tesei. He's former state Senate minority leader. Richard, it's great to see you again.
Happy to be here again.
Well, let's start with you, Richard. Your thoughts on the Trump administration's decision to rescind DACA in the next 6 months.
Well, you know, I support the program, and I think it is important to have a permanent pathway for those students, for those young people to be able to stay in the country. And the problem, as I see it, is that, you know, when President Obama issued his executive order, it was really never supposed to be a permanent solution. Mm-hmm. It was always a temporary fix, a stopgap measure. And, you know, in those individuals are always going to be vulnerable. So in a way, I think what President Trump did is probably the right thing for the long term, and that is to tell Congress, and Ed Markey and Catherine Clark, who you just interviewed, and all the congressmen in both parties, do your job and legislate a fix, because clearly there are a lot of people who felt that this program's unconstitutional. And the final thing I'd say is when President Obama issued this edict, you know, to create this program, mm-hmm. he also did DAPA, if
right.
you remember,
right.
and that
yep.
was struck down by the courts. And most people who have looked at this have said that DACA would be struck down. So why, Aaron, have the uncertainty? You know, why not have Congress in the six-month period get their act together, do the job, and come up with a permanent
Yeah, I mean,
solution.
Take your point. In a way, Michael, the president's actions forced Congress's hand. But then when he tweeted just like a few hours later or the next day that if Congress doesn't do anything, and he, as he said in that tape that we just played, that he might come back and do it, I mean, how much of Congress's hand did he end up forcing?
Right. I mean, I think this kind of just underlines his kind of belief, you'd almost say in chaos theory or something like that. I mean, because really the moves are just incoherent when you line them all up. I mean, they claim that this was an unconstitutional reach of executive power. He strikes it down. You know, he's labeled sort of the cruel anti-immigrant president. He then says, I love the Dreamers. Congress should authorize a permanent solution. And then if they don't, I may act. The implication being he'll go back and perhaps again assert that same executive power that he and certainly his attorney general claim is beyond their reach.
Mm. But, you know, I think it is important to put in context. You had the attorney general of Texas and a number of other attorney generals from other states about to file suit against DACA, the same attorney generals who filed suit against DAPA and
right.
won, and, you know, and ended up stopping the program. So ultimately, something has to happen. And, you know, I think I was on the show maybe 6 months ago, we were talking about this, and I said, you know, this may be Nixon goes to China. You know, Nixon was the only person who could, you know, the rabid anti-communist who could go in and establish a relationship with China. And maybe it is, at the end of the day, Trump is the only one who can break the logjam, you know, that we've had in this country that goes all the way back, I mean, President Bush, Obama,
yeah.
you know, and get some type of, you know, immigration legislation through.
Richard,
this
is the madman theory of immigration legislation for the United States.
But I think,
Michael,
most congressmen want to vote for something, and maybe this is the opportunity.
I mean, you know, I think that's the hopeful view. I mean, it's certainly also worth remembering that the whole reason we had DACA and had this deferred action was Congress's inaction and inability
for
to pass
15, 16
to pass
years,
anything.
Right?
So now we're looking to a Congress that has shown itself to be almost more, you know, more dysfunctional than it's been at any time in that 15 years, more incapable of coming to some agreement on things, and we're going to look to them to get it done. I mean, I sort of feel like the one sort of glimmer of hope you might have is that this would effectively be kind of a rollback of a government benefit, if you want to sort of broadly think of DACA that way. And in general, we've been
the
as a
benefit
country,
here being not getting deported.
Right, right. I mean, it's a loose, you know, sort of stretch of sort of a benefit, but it's been extended to almost a million people. And in general, we've been reluctant to roll things back. And I think that was really is part of the whole problem they had with repeal of the health care law, is that there was a lot of opposition to it originally, but once it's in place, it's hard to roll back. And so we'll see if they, you know, I think that's working in favor.
So I just want to, sorry to interrupt you there, Michael, yeah. but both of you made some points which were captured by Congressman Michael Capuano. We talked with him earlier this week about the DACA decision, and he said that absolutely, he wants Congress to take up this issue, but he is uncertain about its ability to do anything because, in his words, Congress hasn't shown the ability to do anything so far.
It does fall on the Republican leadership to get this issue on the agenda. Let's have that open and honest debate. Let the votes fall where they may. And I, like everything else, if we could do this, we're not going to get a bill that I'm going to like or that you're going to like, but we can get a bill. It's just like health care. It'll be something. It'll be a step in the right direction. I believe there is a majority of Congress willing to do that if we are allowed to do it.
So, Richard, let me ask you a question, because earlier this week we also talked about sort of the tortured history of immigration reform in Congress and the failed attempts. And my question is that right wing of the Republican Party that, you know, deep six, the last attempt at immigration reform, it hasn't really changed in its influence or its stature there. So what makes us think that they're not going to try and undermine any attempts to even get the DREAM Act?
Because this has to be a Democrat and Republican solution. You know, and we saw a glimmer of hope maybe this week where, you know, President Trump was able to get a debt extension with Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi. And, you know, he wants his wall. You know, they want DACA to be extended. You know, maybe you can cobble something together where both, you know, you're taking care of the, because the problem here is, you know, most people, I think, support DACA, but they're worried about, well, if you do this, you know, you're going to have another wave coming. So, you know, take care of the border security part and then take care of the people who are here already and say, you know, it's a new day and we're starting to move forward. Both sides get what they want, and maybe that's the solution that will end up happening.
It's a little hard for me to see. Sometimes it feels like, even just in the course of this week, that the goal of the Trump administration is like an ever-shifting target. Because White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked on the day of the DACA decision, you know, would the president sign something that's just like the DREAM Act alone, just taking care of the DACA recipients, or is he looking for more comprehensive immigration reform? And she seemed to indicate that he wanted a bigger package. And to me, that raises all sorts of challenges, because, like, as we're saying here, the DREAM Act seems to have pretty strong bipartisan support. But you bring in all the other factors, the wall and border security and things like that. That's a harder sell right now.
Right. Absolutely. And the wall, Democrats have said, is a non-starter as part of a package. So.
Right. But then, you know, but again, you know, look what just happened. Everybody wanted that flood relief. And, you know, and it was a big question about, you know, whether they were going to be able to continue to fund the government. And they found a way to compromise with both parties. And I think, you know, the only way government's going to function properly right now, or in any way, is for Democrats and Republicans to each get half a loaf, you know, and give up half a loaf. And that's what the American people, I think, want.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that that's possible right now. On Tuesday, I mean, for the very least reason is that there are 800,000 people right now who are currently looking at the next 6 months and worrying about their future, which could be dire. And we spoke with one of them. She's a DACA recipient, Valeria Duvalle. She came to the United States with her mother and sister when she was 7. And she said the administration's decision to rescind DACA, in a way, actually doesn't make her any more afraid.
10 out of those 13 years, I was fully undocumented with my family. For 3 years, I had DACA, but I still, you know, my family was under threat of deportation. And so it's not like, you know, our fear of deportation never went away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I've been afraid for 13 years. I have not been afraid just beginning today.
Michael, just what's your thought on there are 8,000 DACA recipients in Massachusetts. This is sort of the impact of this decision on the Commonwealth.
I mean, I think it's huge here because, you know, we have we have all these DACA recipients, but we're such a gateway into opportunity through, you know, the breadth of our education institutions here, and you know, it's had a chilling effect, I think almost even greater than the numbers would indicate when you hear the university leaders, you know, at some colleges, I think Harvard said they have 50 students, so it's not a huge part of their student population, but the ripple effects through all of these institutions that are really have a very strong sort of international flavor to them, and that's really a lot of what sort of defines Massachusetts, the Massachusetts of today.
Mm. Richard, one last thought on DACA before we move on to the week's other news.
I think it's better. I agree with the young woman who was being interviewed. Why live in fear for the next 5 years or 10 years? Why not have this permanently enshrined in the law and just take care of it? And again, Congress, do your job, and yeah, Let's see where we are in 6 months.
Yeah. You know, given what the last 6 months have been like, 6 months seems like an incredibly long period of time.
Attach it to flood relief. And
then it'll go. Okay. Right. Well, speaking of weather-related disasters, let's move on to the fact that Hurricane Irma is still barreling towards the United States. The National Hurricane Center is calling it extremely dangerous and warning of life-threatening inundation. I mean, I think that's kind of formal Hurricane Center language for OMG, because this thing is a monster. The governor of Virginia has just declared an emergency in his state. There are states of emergency already in place in the Carolinas and Georgia and in Florida. Governor Rick Scott urged residents in evacuation zones to get out ahead of the storm, saying that all Floridians should be prepared to evacuate.
Today is the day to do the right thing for your family and get to safety. This storm is wider than our entire state and expected to cause major life-threatening impacts from coast to coast. Remember, Hurricane Andrew is one of the worst storms in the history of the state. Irma is more devastating on its current path.
And several islands in the Caribbean already know this. Barbuda Prime Minister Gaston Brown estimated that 95% of the island sustained major damage from Hurricane Irma. On Wednesday, he spoke with the local news station ABS Television.
The extent of the destruction in Barbuda is unprecedented. In fact, I'm of the view that as it stands now, that Barbuda is barely habitable.
It's shocking to listen to, but I suppose even more shocking if you're experiencing it. Michael, just first of all, your thoughts that we're talking about yet another monstrous hurricane so soon after Harvey hit Texas.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to absorb. I mean, I think just for the sort of the psyche of the country, I think it's certainly testing the ability of emergency responders, the federal government. They keep assuring us that things are that they can handle both this and what's happened in Texas at the same time. But and then I think, you know, sort of looming over it is this concern that this is foreshadowing sort of, you know, more of this to come potentially with changes in the climate.
It's because it looks like even right now there's another storm coming up behind Irma. Richard, your thoughts?
Well, you know, we just went through a period where we didn't have a major hurricane in the country for the last 12 years. There were three in Florida in 2014, and then Katrina was, mm-hmm. as everybody remembers, was in 2015. And I think most people have got kind of lax and, you know, sort of underestimated or just sort of forgot, had a little amnesia when it came to, you know, but then all of a sudden to get pounded twice by huge unprecedented storms back to back, I think has a lot of people concerned. And, you know, I don't know if this is like a long-term shift in our weather patterns or if this is just a, you know, a cycle that we're going in because we went through a fairly moderate cycle. But I think, you know, we're going to have to keep our eyes on it. And
So just because I also get all the storm names confused, I think Katrina was 2005,
oh, I'm
right?
Sorry.
And
I'm
it was
sorry.
Sandy was 2015.
I meant 2004 and
2005. Okay.
So we've gone 12 years
right.
without a major. You know, I do want to say just watching this, compared to Katrina, the government, you know, everybody thinks can't get anything right, has done a pretty good job in Texas and so far in Florida. And it's very, it makes you feel good that, you know, the government is doing something very competently, at least up until this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, there were so many, speaking of Katrina, there were so many lessons learned that we can see those lessons being played out on the ground. I mean, just one difference, of course, between Texas and Florida right now is that there was the decision not to evacuate in Houston, which is still somewhat controversial. But they're not taking any chances in Florida. They're, you know, we just heard the governor say virtually the major parts of the state should evacuate. But we've got some tape here from President Trump speaking about Hurricane Irma today. This is in a video message to Americans.
We are doing everything we can to help with disaster preparations. And when the time comes, we will restore, recover, and rebuild together as Americans.
Mm. And the restore, recover, and rebuild part, especially for example, in Houston right now, could take years, which is putting incredible pressure on FEMA. And Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida spoke about funding for FEMA at a press conference on Wednesday.
Of all the costs that FEMA has in Texas right now, they have run out of money, period. They've got to have a temporary tide over of additional funds, not only for that, but especially if the U.S. gets hit.
Now, Congress did give final approval today for a bill that provides $15.25 billion for emergency disaster aid, which includes a little over $7 billion for FEMA's disaster relief fund. But it did come close to running out of money. So Michael, you were touching on this earlier. Seems like we're in a period, a long period. We're going to have to get used to major disaster relief like this in whatever part of the United States. Is there a better way to keep FEMA healthily funded, or are we just going to have emergency bill after emergency bill?
Well, I mean, we do need to be more, you know, proactive and be ahead of the curve. I mean, unfortunately, I think government often, and like with many institutions, they're reactive. And so in this case, you know, they're responding to the acute crisis of the moment. And as you were saying, at the same time, there's been sort of this long-term proposals to cut funding for FEMA and for some of the agencies that plan for and try to anticipate and sort of, you know, mitigate the effects of disasters. So we can't, I mean, it's a pretty schizophrenic approach, and we should have them all on the same page.
Yeah. Richard, your thoughts?
Reminds me of the snow account in the state budget here in Massachusetts. It's never funded properly, and we get walloped with blizzards, and you have to do a supplemental appropriation.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sort of – I think we're always going to make sure that there's ample resources available whenever these things happen. And what the Congress did this week is obviously the right thing. They acted really quickly, and they're going to have to act a lot more because that's just not even a down payment on, you know, what's going to be needed in the months and years ahead to rebuild Texas. And we'll see about Florida.
Well, given how warm the waters off the Atlantic coast are, it seems like this hurricane season, we're nowhere near the end of it. So
we'll see how far in the alphabet we get by the end of the season.
This is I, right? So gosh,
Jose is next.
And so that puts us near halfway. So, okay. Well, I mean, you know, for all the folks listening who either have family or friends or connections down in Florida, we wish you all the best of luck. In the last couple minutes that we have, though, Michael and Richard, I want to talk about one last piece of news, and that's that the members of the Cannabis Control Commission in the state have now been named. And this is the commission that's in charge of spearheading the effort in Massachusetts to get the legal marijuana industry up and running. 5 members of the commission, 4 of them oppose the legislation that legalized, or I should say the voter referendum that legalized pot in Massachusetts. The new head of the commission, Stephen Hoffman, spoke at a press conference on Wednesday, and he explained his vote against legalization last year.
I was a private citizen back in November of 2016. I actually support the objectives of the initiative. My concern as a private citizen was that I thought the timeline was pretty short to deal with some of the complexities and public safety issues involved with implementing the law, but I'm a supporter of the objectives of the law.
And now he's the head of the commission and has to deal with that timeline. So, Michael, your thoughts on the Cannabis Control Commission now being fully staffed?
I mean, it's obviously a great move to get it done. I think that there are some legitimate concerns that it seemed a little stacked with opponents. I do think that the chairman, Steve Hoffman's appointment and sort of designating him as an opponent comes with a little bit of an asterisk because he did say, I mean, he broadly supports the idea of legalizing marijuana and has said, you know, he said he thinks it's no more harmful than alcohol if used in moderation, if kept away from minors, et cetera. So I think there's a little more balance there than some of the pro-pot folks have suggested, but you know, I think they have a huge challenge in front of them,
yeah.
and I think it's still quite possible they won't hit that July 1st deadline. You know, I'm not sure. I think it's, as some have said, because the commission members are going to look to sabotage it. They just there's a lot to get done, and there isn't as much time as they probably need.
Or possibly enough money, right?
Because
State Treasurer Deb Goldberg estimated she would need $10 million for the first year to really set up this regulatory framework around pot, but the legislator appropriated just $2 million for this year. Is that a problem, Richard?
Well, you know what? Yeah, I think it is, and I can see why people would be a little paranoid. We are talking about marijuana, because Massachusetts really doesn't have the best track record when it comes to bringing ballot questions to fruition.
Yeah.
And you have the casino. You know, we don't have a casino built yet, but medical marijuana, the 3 years into it, it hasn't really taken off, and they're watching what's happening here. But I got to agree. I do think that the chairman allayed a lot of those fears in his interview. And I think the reason why 4 of the 5 were against, you had the AG, you had the treasurer, and you had the governor. I don't think any of them wanted to appoint a pro person because they don't want to own it. So you can appoint somebody who's against it and let them do their business, but you're not really, you know, they were all opposed to the question. So this way they get to say, well, you know, I mean, nobody wants to take ownership of this thing, but hopefully it will move forward.
Yeah.
And the will of the voters will be adhered to.
Well, and I mean, given how much interest did surround the actual ballot question, that pressure isn't going to go away. So lots of eyes will be on the commission as it does its work. Well, we've got just a couple minutes left, and it's enough time for our hubbubs. And Michael, I flipped an imaginary coin, and it came up you, your hubbub.
So I have a sort of looking ahead hubbub that's sort of a shout out to the Celebrity Series of Boston. And starting next Wednesday on the Rose Kennedy Greenway, they will be sponsoring a free 5 days running dance concert, really, that everyone can take part of. They're going to have dance lessons and then live music. And whether you want to learn to salsa dance or swing dance, or if going back to the 70s and disco is your thing, and they did this. They skipped last year, but 2 years ago they had it, and there were hundreds or thousands of people on the Greenway dancing. And I think it's a fun thing. And for Boston and its sort of reputation for being kind of stodgy,
yeah,
and a little reserved, if there's anything to show that maybe we're sort of a different Boston, this would seem like good evidence of it. So
that sounds terrific.
Get out and dance.
Salsa dancing on the Greenway. Love it. Richard.
So don't be surprised if when you're on the Greenway, you start seeing signature collectors everywhere, because those who are looking to place ballot questions for the 2018 ballot have until December 6th to gather and submit 64,750 certified signatures from registered voters throughout the state. And the scramble started this week because the Attorney General came out. She looked at all the ballot questions that were submitted and gave them a constitutional stamp of approval. So now the rush has started. And what's pretty remarkable about this particular time that we're in is there were 21 different questions. And not all of them are going to make it to the end of the thing.
We could hardly handle the 4 from
process.
Last time around.
Exactly. But I did a little math, and if all 21 did move forward, that would be 1,350,000 signatures. So with your dance contest, or you're at a county fair or a sporting event, you're going to see these people and give them a signature. It's part of the process, and it's not always easy to collect them all. I've been doing that myself, but that's a lot of John Hancock. So
yeah. That's the hard toil of grassroots democracy there, and the million plus signatures. All right, so my hubbub is a really little one. It's not even actually news of any kind, but just this morning with my producer Allison Bruzek, I was at the Harvard Natural History Museum, and we were just looking at some old samples that they have and collected specimens, and we were shown one jar that had a turtle's shell in it. And every jar that they have of the thousands that they have at the Harvard Natural History Museum, there's a label that says the species name, where it was collected, and in some cases, who collected it. So this one had the name, the scientific name of the turtle on it, and the location of the collection was Concord, Massachusetts. And it was collected by none other than Henry David Thoreau.
Wow.
So a Thoreauvian turtle at the Harvard Natural History Museum is my hubbub of the day. Michael Jonas, Executive Director of Commonwealth Magazine, Executive Editor, I should say. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Richard Tessay, former State Senate Minority Leader. It was great to have you, Richard. Thanks so much.
Happy to.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.